From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, before heading to Hawaii, President Obama delivers his assessment of 2013. Violence continues in South Sudan as the UN condemns a deadly attack on its compound.
So the political crisis could lead to a general civil war if we don't solve very quickly the political crisis.
We're in Uganda, where a new law could punish homosexual acts with life in prison. And we speak to the Pennsylvanian pastor who was defrocked for presiding over his gay son's wedding.
It was an act of love. I did it for my son. My wife and I really affirmed him by saying that, you know, he is created in the image of God, just like everybody else. There's nothing wrong with being homosexual.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama confirmed that he is reviewing the 46 recommendations made by an independent White House-sponsored panel on National Security Agency programs. The president said he will announce new policies for the NSA in January. The intelligence agency has been broadly criticized for violating privacy rights with its data collection programs, as revealed by fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. From Washington, Priscilla Huff has more.
U.S. President Barack Obama is evaluating 46 recommendations from the Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technologies and rulings from federal judges about the intelligence-gathering practices of the NSA.
I have confidence in the fact that the NSA is not engaging in domestic surveillance or snooping around.
But he also acknowledges that Americans are not confident. In fact, the world is not confident that the NSA is not using the huge amount of data it has collected inappropriately. President Obama says the goal of the NSA must remain the same, to collect information which would prevent a terrorist attack. He'll reveal his recommendations in January.
And earlier, President Obama warned that South Sudan stands at the precipice. He's called on leaders in the world's youngest nation to stop the violence. His words came after political clashes spilled over into ethnic violence, in which hundreds have been killed, including three UN peacekeepers. Nina Maria Potts reports.
U.S. President Barack Obama has warned that recent fighting in South Sudan threatens to plunge the world's youngest country back into the dark days of the past. Some of the worst violence came in the volatile state of Jonglei. On Thursday, a small UN outpost in the remote town of Akobo in the east of the state was overrun in a revenge attack. Three Indian peacekeepers were killed trying to protect the base from the mob, who also killed more than a dozen government officials from South Sudan's most powerful tribe, the Dinka. The U.S. has also deployed 45 American military personnel to South Sudan to protect the U.S. embassy and Americans there.
Former jailed Russian oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky has arrived in Germany after being unexpectedly pardoned by President Vladimir Putin. He was released from jail on Friday morning and immediately boarded a flight to Germany, where his mother is undergoing medical treatment. With reaction from Moscow, here's Tom Barton.
The dominant explanation is an attempt to ease international criticism of Russia's human rights record as the Winter Olympics in Sochi approach. The influential Daily Kommersant says security officials paid Khodorkovsky a private visit, warning him new cases were being prepared against him and that his mother's health was deteriorating, and forcing him to ask for a pardon. The other main point, featured in papers such as the Business Daily Vedomosti, is that Khodorkovsky no longer poses a risk to Putin.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. economy grew at its fastest rate since late 2011, with a final GDP revision from the government showing the economy grew much faster in the third quarter of 2013 than was previously expected. Quinn Bowman reports from New York.
Consumer spending helped push U.S. economic growth to one of its strongest quarters in recent years. It's yet more positive news for the world's largest economy, which is still struggling to recover from the 2008 financial crisis. From July to September, the economy grew at an annualized rate of 4.1%, revised from a previous estimate of 3.6%. A large part of the growth was due to personal consumption spending. That figure rose by 2%. The U.S. Federal Reserve expects the economy to grow between 2.8% and 3.2% in 2014.
And a U.S. Air Force general in charge of nuclear forces was dismissed over his alcohol-fueled behavior on an official visit to Russia. The reasons for his firing have emerged from the investigation into the trip to Moscow back in July. Other members of the American delegation were reportedly shocked by his antics, as Malcolm Brown reports.
According to the official report, the drinking started on the journey to Russia. Major General Michael Carey reportedly appeared drunk during a layover in Zurich, where he talked loudly about his important job. Things only got worse in Russia, where the report details late nights, heavy drinking, rude behaviour, and spending time with foreign women, who by his own admission were somewhat suspect. The general, who was in charge of America's ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, was relieved of his command in October. It's just the latest in a string of embarrassing episodes involving America's nuclear forces.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. In a rare press conference at the White House today, President Obama reflected on the government's successes and failures. He lamented the inability of Congress to pass federal gun control measures following a year of deadly mass shootings and extend the emergency unemployment insurance of the long-term jobless.
Because Congress didn't act, more than 1 million of their constituents will lose a vital economic lifeline at Christmas time, leaving a lot of job seekers without any source of income at all. I think we're a better country than that. We don't abandon each other when times are tough. Keep in mind, unemployment insurance only goes to folks who are actively looking for work. A mom who needs help feeding her kids when she sends out her resumes, or a dad who needs help paying the rent while working part-time and still earning the skills he needs for that new job. So when Congress comes back to work, their first order of business should be making this right.
And while he called the rollout of the healthcare reform law his biggest mistake of the year, he said improvements to the website and outreach to the uninsured have led to an uptick in enrollment in state and federal healthcare exchanges.
Millions of Americans, despite the problems with the website, are now poised to be covered by quality, affordable health insurance come New Year's Day.
But President Obama did not address his decision this week to commute and pardon a total of 21 people who have been serving decades-long prison terms for non-violent drug offences, people who were sentenced under laws that have since been amended. In Washington, Alice Olstein has the details.
Among the prisoners granted clemency by the president this week is Clarence Aaron, who was sentenced 20 years ago to life in prison for playing a minor role in two planned drug deals, one of which never took place. He was a college student at the time and had no prior criminal record. Another is Stephanie George, a single mother of three serving life without parole for helping a boyfriend sell crack cocaine. At her trial, the judge said, quote, "Your role has basically been as a girlfriend and bag holder and money holder. Certainly, in my judgment, it doesn't warrant a life sentence. I wish I had another alternative." George's children were ages 4, 6, and 8 when she was incarcerated and are now in their early 20s.
Prison does not stop at the prison walls. It affects family members, loved ones.
That's Anthony Papa, a spokesperson for the research and reform advocacy group Drug Policy Alliance. He is also a former prisoner, sentenced to 15 years to life in jail under mandatory minimum laws for a nonviolent drug offense. He was granted clemency by New York Governor George Pataki in the late 90s after serving 12 years, which he said restored his humanity.
Mandatory minimum sentences takes away the discretion of the judge to look at the facts. They were created, maybe what not the intention of being racist, but they are racist in nature. They're handcuffed and they're given these sentences. In my case, the judge didn't want to give me a 15 life sentence, but he had to because of mandatory minimum sentencing. Hundreds of thousands of people are put in prison. They're stuck there. Judges don't want to sentence them to these draconian sentences, but they are. They have to. And I think that when they're done away with, the system can be repaired.
This week, President Obama commuted the sentences of 8 people and pardoned 13 others, people who were sentenced under laws that have since been changed by Congress. In a statement, he said, quote, "Because of a disparity in the law that is now recognized as unjust, they remain in prison, separated from their families and their communities at a cost of millions of taxpayer dollars each year." Prior to this week's action, President Obama had only pardoned 39 people and commuted only one sentence, which is the fewest of any president in recent history.
Well, we expect there's upwards of thousands of people within the criminal justice system that were convicted and have had mandatory minimum sentences applied to them.
That's Tanya Clay House of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She cited studies that found that more than 3,000 people across the country are serving life sentences for nonviolent offenses, and 65% of those are African American, many of them sentenced under old laws that sentenced crack users to prison terms exponentially longer than cocaine users. President Obama signed a law that reduced that disparity, but it came too late for those incarcerated under the old regime. A bill introduced in Congress this past summer would make the Fair Sentencing Act retroactive for some offenders, but it has only gotten 4 co-sponsors so far and has been stuck in committee for months. President Obama urged Congress this week to take further action on sentencing reform in 2014. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
It's been a popular week for presidential pardons. Along with Barack Obama's commutations, Russia's Vladimir Putin made a surprise pardon when he gave the green light for one of his most high-profile critics to be freed. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, once Russia's richest man, was granted a pardon after a decade in jail for tax evasion and fraud. His supporters maintain his imprisonment was politically motivated. For more on the story, I spoke to FSN's Moscow correspondent Anya Ardaeva.
The decision to pardon the former head of oil giant Yukos, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was certainly very unexpected. It came right after Vladimir Putin's annual press conference. He did not make the announcement during the press conference, but after minutes after it was over. And that decision certainly took many people here by surprise. Mikhail Khodorkovsky left prison the next day, and that was very quick. Certainly nobody expected that to happen so fast. He went to Germany immediately after his release. He apparently flew to Berlin, where his mother and his father are expected to arrive over the weekend. His mother is reportedly not feeling well, and that served as a main reason, according to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, for his decision to release Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He said he has already spent a long time in prison, over a decade, and that this punishment was a serious one, and that he released Khodorkovsky for humanitarian reasons, citing that he wanted to go see his mother as she was not feeling well.
Khodorkovsky released a brief written statement, and in that he said that the, you know, walking free from jail, there was no discussion on the issue of his guilt, because this is a man who human rights groups have labelled Putin's prisoner, and have always been question marks over the charges for which he was imprisoned. Can you just give us some background?
Khodorkovsky was imprisoned over 10 years ago on charges of embezzlement and fraud. In October of 2003, he was arrested and has not left jail ever since. The international human rights organization Amnesty International has called Mikhail Khodorkovsky a political prisoner for the reasons that prior to his arrest in 2003, Mikhail Khodorkovsky has conducted quite a lot of political activity. He was at one point the richest man in Russia, and he used his wealth, estimated at one point at $20 billion, to sponsor various political parties and movements that were in opposition to the Kremlin. And according to many observers here, the reason for his arrest and his prison sentence was his political activity, not actually the crimes that he, according to the court, the Russian court, has committed during the 1990s when he was building his massive oil empire and his company, oil giant Yukos, which after his imprisonment has been broken up into several parts.
Kremlin critics have viewed Putin's clemency for the likes of Khodorkovsky and the potential amnesty for the remaining members of the Pussy Riot punk band, along with the Greenpeace Arctic activists, as his attempt to clear up or clean up a reputation with the international community with regards to human rights ahead of Sochi 2014, the Winter Games.
That's correct. The amnesty bill that was just passed by the Russian lower house of parliament includes amnesty for Pussy Riot punk band members who are serving their two-year prison term for staging a protest at Moscow's cathedral, as well as 30 activists from a Greenpeace protest ship who are facing charges of hooliganism. They were in jail for 2 months waiting for their charges and their trial. And all of these people are now subject to an amnesty that was just passed by the Russian state Duma. And certainly this is viewed as a Russian response, as a Russian attempt to ease international criticism of Russia's human rights record, especially just 2 months ahead of Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, less than 2 months. And while that decision to free all those prisoners is welcomed by the West, there are certainly voices here, critical voices of the Kremlin. They warn that it is way too early to claim that the situation with human rights in Russia following the release of those prisoners has dramatically improved for the better. They say it's too premature to claim that. We have to wait and see what happens after the games.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Anya Ardaeva. This is FSN Reports. The United Nations has condemned the attack on its compound in South Sudan, in which two peacekeepers and more than 20 civilians were killed. It's the latest wave of violence in the country that is battling ethnic killings following a failed coup. At least 500 people have been killed in the capital Juba, and tens of thousands are sheltering in UN compounds. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
As the violence in South Sudan continues to escalate, the United Nations is trying to deal with the rapidly deteriorating situation. Friday was meant to be the start of the Security Council Christmas holiday, with no meeting scheduled to take place. But special closed-door consultations were convened to discuss what they're calling the humanitarian crisis. Speaking to reporters after the meeting, the president of the Security Council, France's ambassador Gerard Oroud, expressed the council's grave concern.
You have the political crisis and you have a powder keg, which is the ethnic question. So the political crisis could lead to a general civil war if we don't solve very quickly the political crisis.
Up to 40,000 civilians have fled the fighting, flocking to UN bases around the country to seek shelter. But the peacekeepers' mandate to protect them has been severely tested. More details emerged on Friday about the attack on the UN compound in Akabo, where 36 people of the Dinka ethnicity were sheltering. Just 43 UN peacekeepers and half a dozen policemen tried to stop an armed mob of 2,000. During the attack, two Indian peacekeepers were killed, another injured. And the exact number of the Dinka civilians who were murdered when the mob overran the compound is still unclear, as Ambassador Oroud explained.
We believe that at least 20 of them were killed. It could be the 36 of them, actually. It's really simply because we don't have all the information. And we are organizing the evacuation now of the peacekeepers from Akobo.
Another compound in UI has now been emptied, 40 peacekeepers helicoptered out. Meanwhile, the situation is still extremely tense at a number of other compounds throughout the country. Ambassador Oroud said that it was very unstable at one in Bor, where 14,000 people are staying, with fighting breaking out around the compound. At one base in Juba, where 10,000 people have gathered, the UN's resources are being stretched. The mission's representative, Toby Lanza, is there.
I've just walked through one of these bases. I've listened to women and children, to a lot of men who are concerned about their own safety, and that's why they've come to the United Nations. And what we as a peacekeeping mission, what we as a UN team can do for people is first and foremost help them with their protection, help them to be able to seek refuge in a safe place. And in addition to that, we will be providing water.
There's concern the ethnic violence may be heading the way of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. But UN spokesperson Farhan Haq said he didn't think so.
The difference between this and Rwanda is that the whole world is watching right now, today. No one can say that we haven't been warned. No one can say that we at the United Nations also have not been speaking out right at the start. But what's needed is for enough pressure from parties in South Sudan, but also from all concerned countries in the region and elsewhere, to get the leaders to halt the fighting.
Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson has also urged political dialogue to take place as soon as possible.
Violence is spreading and could spread even further. We need all South Sudanese leaders and political personalities now to immediately appeal to calm and call on their supporters to suspend hostilities.
The UN mission in South Sudan numbers nearly 7,000 peacekeepers and police, but only around 4,000 are armed. At this stage, the UN Security Council is ruling out sending more peacekeepers. The hope is the fighting will stop, and the world's youngest country will find a political solution to the potential civil war. Nick Harper, New York.
Defrocked by the church for officiating his son's same-sex wedding. Frank Schaefer, who pastors a United Methodist church in Pennsylvania, defied church law when he presided over his son's wedding in 2007. That's according to Methodist officials. The ruling was met with a strong opposition from dozens of Pennsylvania clergy. Speaking to Frank Schaefer earlier, he told me he plans to appeal the decision.
Well, I had a meeting with the Board of Ordained Ministry of the United Methodist Church at Valley Forge at the conference center, and that was the body the jury decided needed to hear the interview from me and receive a written report. And so I met with about 40, 45 ministers that are on the board, and my statement was read, and the question was asked, can you uphold the Book of Discipline in its entirety? And my answer to that was, unfortunately, I cannot.
Why is that? Why can you not? Why can you not uphold those values?
The problem is, most of the book is good. Most of the rules are okay, except for those discriminatory laws. I cannot uphold them. I will not refuse ministry to people based on their sexual orientation. I will offer gay marriage to them, and I'm also opposed to, you know, forbidding homosexual members of our church to become ordained ministers. So I just could not say that I can uphold the Book of Discipline, our church law, in its entirety. And at that point, my credentials were being taken from me.
And what will happen now? Will you appeal?
Yes, actually, we have already appealed. And we think we have a pretty good case because the jury's penalty really was based on a conditional, and we feel that wasn't fair. I mean, you can't be punished for something you haven't committed yet. So by me saying I cannot uphold the Book of Discipline, I will continue to do gay marriages. Well, I haven't done any yet, and we feel that you can't be punished for something that hasn't occurred yet.
Mr. Schaefer, can you explain, for anyone who isn't up to date with this or hasn't been following this story from the beginning, you have been suspended. Can you explain why that suspension came about from the church?
Yes, it was all because of a wedding, a same-gender wedding I did for my son back in 2007. And somebody in my congregation actually reported that only this year, in 2013, it took 6 years, but it finally did happen, and so I was officially charged by the church, and there was a trial, and at the trial I tried to defend myself by saying, you know, it was an act of love. I did it for my son. My son had gone through some rough times. He had suicidal thoughts at one point as a teenager, and my wife and I really affirmed him by saying that, you know, he is created in the image of God, just like everybody else. And there's nothing wrong with being homosexual. And so I felt like I really had to do this as an act of affirmation and love for him, and was hoping that that defense would yield a different outcome. But in the end, you know, the church stuck by the book and defrocked me.
But is it fair to say that there has been a groundswell of support from within the United Methodist Church?
Absolutely, there have been critics, but the majority of the people that have contacted me and that have approached me and have written about me really are in support and really have encouraged me. I'm actually overwhelmed by the support. I can't believe how many LGBT members of our church have contacted me and shared their story with me and said, you know, stand strong, we're behind you. So it's really amazing.
Considering the position you now find yourself in, Mr. Schaefer, do you have any regrets over the role you played in your son's wedding?
No, I have no regrets. I did what I did based on my conscience, following my heart, and I would do the same thing again.
Reverend Frank Schaefer. The rights of homosexuals are also attracting domestic and international attention in Uganda after the country's parliament passed an anti-gay bill that could see homosexual acts punished with life behind bars. The legislation, which has been stagnating since 2009, has provoked international outcry and has already seen some nations threaten to stop aid to Uganda. A parliamentary statement said the bill aims at strengthening the nation's capacity to deal with emerging internal and external threats to the traditional heterosexual family. FSN's Justin Drelays is in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, and spoke to me earlier.
The anti-homosexuality bill is kind of watered down version of what was initially started. The initial bill talked about death penalty to homosexuality and all and aggravated homosexuality, but this time they removed the death penalty, and what you have as the maximum penalty is life imprisonment for aggravated homosexuality. Now, the definition of aggravated homosexuality is what is in contention. The architects of the bill have been selling it as a bill to protect Ugandan children, to protect Ugandan marriages, to protect culture and preserve civilization.
Clearly a victory for the Conservatives in Uganda, but what does this mean for the homosexual community? How have they reacted?
A few homosexuals I spoke to on phone today have been, they are in panic, they are scared, they don't know what is going to happen next. They are mobilizing and organizing themselves to take this to court.
Do you think there's any concern about the reaction of the international community to a bill such as this? I mean, when it was first mooted as possible legislation back in 2009, you had the President of the United States describe it as odious.
The government of Uganda is very much aware about international pressure that will come with this. This is why the Prime Minister was actually objecting to debating the bill today. He tried to raise a point about lack of quorum, but it was overruled, and the bill was passed. But obviously, the Ugandan government is fully aware about the international pressure that will come with this.
Do you think the Ugandan government, though, is aware of the possible harm that this decision could do to international aid, for instance?
Yes, Uganda has already had donor aid cuts from Germany. Germany has cut aid. I think Britain also threatened to cut aid over the anti-homosexuality bill. There was a time Gavi, which gives huge chunks of the money for treating HIV in Uganda, also suspended some money for treating AIDS patients in Uganda because of what they said there was discrimination in access to treatment. So the Ugandan government is fully aware when it comes to international pressure and any legislation that is going to make it impossible for homosexuals to live in this country.
Justin Drelays in Kampala. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, the first of our holiday season specials, author and presenter John Suchet shares his passion for composer Ludwig van Beethoven. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.